try to realize I'm the only one who can change myself.
This is Jason Horsley and the Jobcast, and I'm talking to Rurik Skywalker of Slavland Chronicles.
And I might know where to go if only I knew where I'm coming from. And I might see right through me and all of the games I feel I've won. And I might rise.
All right. Well, I'll just briefly tell you the etiology of this conversation, which is that I've been following the neoliberal feudalism site for a little while and getting a lot of useful insights thereon. And I asked that guy about the Ashkenazi thing because I was curious, as there was more material on it. And he pointed me to your conversation with Carl Hamers, I think it is. So basically, that's how I found your site. It was only just a couple of weeks ago. But you're somebody who talks a lot in the interviews, so I found out quite a lot about you and what interests you just in that one conversation. And it just felt like there was an awful lot of overlaps. So basically, that's how and why I'm talking to you now. I thought that maybe we just start with not who you are, because maybe you don't want to talk about that, but what Slavland Chronicles is, like how you came up with that focus, because it's fairly unusual, quite a specific designator.
Sure, but can you tell me about what your particular interest is, like, so I can say stuff that's interesting to your audience?
Well, that's tricky. My particular interest is in long-term global engineering and the propagation of false narratives about who we are and why we're here and how we got here. I mean, just it's a pretty wide focus. I've had a specific interest over the years on conspiracy theories around child abuse, occultism. That's been a kind of major area of interest, but really I've covered so many different bases, not including the Slavlands. That's kind of why I pointed out it's odd that I've ended up in your vicinity, although I can see from your the subjects that you focus on at your podcast, again, there's a lot of overlap.
Okay. So are you going to ask me questions or do you want me to just talk? What were you thinking?
Well, I'm hoping we'll have a conversation. What I found is as long as we have a place to start, then usually the conversation just kind of expands in various directions organically enough. As we said in our PM chat, we can talk about Ukraine just because that's very topical and because I don't know much about it. But beyond that, I'm pretty sure I will have ideas that I want to go into as you talk. So just for now, I'm just curious how and why your focus is on the Slav lands particularly.
Okay. And where are you politically, like roughly speaking,
where
in
am
terms
I?
Of your orientation? Yeah, where's your political home?
I don't have one. I don't have one. Maybe we could talk about that, you know, maybe we could start right there, because that's a very interesting question to me. I was raised by Fabian socialists, though I didn't know it at the time. Champagne socialists, we referred to them. So I was raised with a liberal progressive background and very leftist, but I never even then, you know, I never took on even that programming of being a leftist. I was never leftist. I mean, I was, but I didn't know it because I had that progressive thing just instilled in me. So I had those values, but I didn't extend them to any kind of political affiliation. And then in my 20s, I just renounced all of that stuff and I got into shamanism and occultism. So I my political point of view is that Politics are not going to solve anything. Like I'm kind of anti-political because I see it all as conspiratorial. I see politics as a series of conspiracies, essentially. If somebody were to look at me from the outside, they might they might define me. So far, I haven't been branded as right wing or left wing for that matter. But I would say that I'm pretty conservative by today's standards. It's just that's an irony to me rather than an actual thing I embrace.
I see. Well, yeah, we definitely have some overlap in our ideas. But listen, time is ticking. I think we've already wasted, well, not wasted, but we're 10 minutes in. So
Sure.
anytime you want to just launch it, hit go or whatever, then I
Well,
think I got enough.
okay, good. Well, to me, we did hit go, and to me, all of this is relevant and interesting. I mean, two human beings talking and getting to know each other is where it's really at, in my point of view.
Oh yeah, I didn't mean any offense. It's just usually I'm like I switch into a mode. It's a show for me, like I've never done just like a let's chat and record it type of thing. I usually, I get into it, start talking louder, enunciating that sort of thing, and sort of go listing down the key points. But yeah, if you want to just do it casually, then by all means, I'll just jump in. The cult
Sure.
thing, I think I agree with you on that. There's definitely, I would say that it's not just in politics, it's in everything. It's in war. There's an occult significance to a lot of things that are done. Science is based on a kind of occultism that we have now. I don't think it's secular. I don't even think it's very empirical. I think a religion, obviously. Was based on an occult project, and one of the key themes that I've been expounding on the blog is the concept of the Platonic conspiracy. The key ideas of Platonism being a rebellion against the ancient world, a kind of Bolshevik subversion, as it were, and how these ideas were picked up by nefarious groups and elites throughout the subsequent centuries, and how they advanced this agenda. And so I've written a lot about it, but I still haven't gotten that far history-wise. So we're still somewhere in the 2nd century BC. We're still in Alexandria. But next up is Rome. And before that, I explained how basically Plato's The Republic is, it's basic. Well, it starts with this Russian guy, which is the Russian connection. It's Zamyatin. And he wrote Мы, which is we. And it's about this dystopian futuristic society. But it's actually just the Republic. It's modeled on Plato's Republic. And the guardians are the secret police. That's the philosopher kings. And the funny thing is that on the blog, before I had realized that, before I'd read Zamyatin, I was talking about how essentially we live in a kind of theocracy in the sense that we do have a priesthood. And the priesthood is the spooks. It's this professional spy. It's this professional ideological cast, and a lot of them are in the media, like Tucker Carlson or Anderson Cooper, or I don't know what you have over there in Britain, but it's the same in Russia. It's everybody is to be anybody. Basically, it's like in the Middle Ages, you had to be a feudal lord to have any significance whatsoever, to be a player in the game of culture, of society, of war, of anything. You had to be a feudal lord. You had to be a noble. And it didn't matter what your opinion was, that had to be your caste. And so I say in modernity, it's the same thing, except we don't have feudal lords. We have basically the intelligence agencies. They run everything. They're the ones who, and you just go down the list like this guy's supposed to be on the left. This guy's supposed to be on the right. This guy's talking about feminism. This one's every single one of them is a spook, and like notably so. Like it's open information that they are involved in that sort of thing. So, and I think that they are a sort of occultist, voodoo, secular in quotation marks priesthood. And so, on all things in the science, this trust the science that we got with the vaccines and the mRNA technology, the global warming agenda. All these things are, I see them through a religious lens, through an occult lens, And I'm trying to convince more people to see it that way too. So I think we have a big overlap on that.
Yeah, I just spoke to James Howard Constable yesterday. Do you know his work at all?
Maybe. I'm so bad with names, but.
Well, he's fairly high profile, I guess, for an alternate voice. And he and I see eye to eye on a lot of things, but on this we do not. And so he talks about local, well, national politics a lot, what's going on in the US. And overall, we kind of agree that this is profound malevolence behind what's going on in the world. And he's aware of the WEF and Davos and this, that, he's aware of a conspiratorial element, but he still has this. He was a New York guy who wrote for the Rolling Stone, and he was fairly mainstream, and he still has this, I'd say it's a kind of indoctrinated perspective that eschews large-scale conspiracy theory or conspiracy analysis, right? And but anyway, I was talking to him yesterday about this, and I was trying to say, well, look, you look at this area over here. That's what's going on in the political realm. You're aware that there's an intelligence agencies, and there's this kind of hidden, quote, deep state hand behind it. But he keeps falling back on this view that it's just a few bad apples who've kind of taken over the apparatus for now, and they're going to get exposed, and the justice system is going to bring them down, right? Which I find extremely frustrating. And so I was trying to explain to what you were just talking about, that the way I see it, that there's a consistent element through history which you need to start to map that area also, which has to do with occult secret societies, right? But that it's very tricky to map that area for obvious reasons, partly because it's hidden, but also partly because the kind of research out there about it is kind of dodgy. You end up with David Icke or somebody like that, right? But so what you've zeroed in on there is absolutely the way I see it also, and I was trying to present it to
Well,
Constable.
I would just tell him this: if you get into a conversation with him again, you don't need to look at what secret societies did. You can just look at the open, visible trajectory of elite thinking over however many centuries. Like, start with Platonism. What does Plato say has to be done? What is his background? What is he trying to do? He's a supporter of an atheist government that overthrew the Athenian democracy and tried to institute this Spartan oligarchy, pro-Spartan oligarchy. Radical social reforms were implemented. Like very Trotskyist type things were being experimented with at the time. There was a huge bloodletting. What does he actually write in his book? And just go down the points, and you're like, this is totalitarianism. And this is the core to all Western thinking. And by Western, I include. I mean, Greece is technically to the east, but you know what I'm talking about. White people thinking in general. It's all, this is what our elites were reading. And it's built on, because so Plato's big thing is he wants Sparta. He likes everything about Sparta. He's like, this is the way to go. Let's get rid of let's create basically a slave society. Let's have ideological enforcers who kill anybody who deviates from the norm. Let's make up a religion. Let's create a noble lie. To then force our socially engineered morality upon people. Let's create myths of mythical founders so that people will believe that our ideas and our system's older than it is. I argue that Platonists wrote the Septuagint, and this isn't just my theory. This is like some revisionist biblical scholars are really into that, and it's Russell Gmurkin. Anyway, I go down the full list, and yeah, it's actually very shocking the similarities between. And the thing is that the similarities were so shocking and so apparent that even Philo of Alexandria and these other Helleno-Judaic figures of the turn of the millennium, 2,000 years ago, allegedly, they're all saying, yeah, our writing is very similar to Plato. In fact, it's identical in places. But the reason for that is because Plato must have had a copy of the Bible that he was copying off of. So no one is even disputing that it's the same thing. That the key points, and especially the Pentateuch, that's pretty much what I'm talking about here. The Pentateuch and Timaeus and the ideas in the Republic and laws and Deuteronomy, the overlap is there. Pretty much all the Greek, all the Jewish myths in the Old Testament. straight up stolen from Greek myths. Samson and Hercules. Someone even made a movie in the 80s because there's it's the same character. And then all you're basically debating is who had primacy. Obviously, if you're a Christian, then the Jews are the oldest and the wisest and most blessed nation. If you're a sane person, it's the Greeks, obviously, and it's them copying from Plato because it was the Greek Empire that they were a part of, and whatever. I go through the whole argument, and then from that point onward, you just trace the beliefs. This you, tr you it's very and the thing is that people don't realize it's a conspiracy because they accept 90% of it, and that's how the conspiracy works. Initially, there's a secret group conspiring and trying to affect social change. But once that change is affected, they don't have to conceal themselves. When the communists were not in power in Russia, they were underground. When they took power, it wasn't a conspiracy. They ran the government. You could see them, you know? Same thing. So these people with their ideas, they take over European society and they keep pushing these interesting new ideas with every couple hundred years. Until we get to the situation that we're in now. I mean, this is taught as the history of philosophy, the history of thought. But it's all about the value connotation that you add to it, right? So I can tell you all of this, and I can say, and that's a good thing. And that's what, say, like a Christian theologian will say. He'll tell you about Platonism. He'll tell you about how Christianity is a continuation of Platonist ideals, how they were these virtuous pagans who were really against the ancient world because it was evil and they helped destroy it, and how there's this significant overlap in how the early Christians were Platonists, the early theologians, that is. So they'll say it, but it's just the connotation's different. And you'll find the same thing happening. Every interesting turning point in history where you're like, there was a secret society that was somehow influencing things here. After a while, they're no longer a secret. Their thing is mainstream. They don't have to hide. And the masses are like, well, you have a problem with this? What are you, some kind of in the 19th century, what's a slur that they would use? What are you, some kind of Nazi? Imagine some 17th century French farmer. What are you, some kind of Nazi? You think there's a Illuminati? Like, if you know what I mean, if you get what I'm driving at. But I'd say the conspiracy, 90% of it is visible. It's just people accept it. That's the problem.
This is something that I looked at, the Advice of Kings, specific examples like movements that basically are successful, they just become integrated into society, or society gets integrated into them, and so it looks as though they failed in some way. If you look at them, you go, well, that movement just sort of disappeared. Where did it go? Oh, it's everywhere, right? It's actually
Can
taken
I
over.
give another example? Maybe you know this one, like the Kabbalah. So the Kabbalah got big in Europe. There was controversy. The church initially accepted it because it was commentaries on Moses, basically, and the Old Testament, supposedly written by Moses. It was written by Moses, but a different Moses. Anyway, it's shut down after a while, and then it reemerges as Christian Kabbalah. And right around that time, science, as we know it now, with its key concepts, emerges alongside it, with the big names, like Newton, for example, who are all into this. And they put their occult ideas into this fledgling new thing that we call science, and it forms the core assumptions of the whole thing. And now everybody's like into science, everyone except no one knows the occult origins of it. But a lot of these strange scientific theories that can't really be proven with backyard science, they're all derived from occult texts. I mean, black holes, Einstein's theories, the whole controversy over his relativity theories, it was not accepted at the time. And it seems to have been forced through by powerful elite actors. And you can't prove these black holes. It's a whole thing you can get into, like that a lot of our modern science is very hard to prove at all, like objectively, empirically. It's just sort of, it's magic. It's like numbers and squiggly lines and symbols on a blackboard. It's all theoretical. It's a bunch of assumptions. And so it's a lot like spell casting. It's a lot like sorcery. And I was getting, I had a, and this guy that you mentioned, our mutual contact, Carl Hamers, he's into that as well. He explains it as the transition from sorcery to scientism. And they wrote about what their plans were all the way back in the 16th century. They were talking about building a new Atlantis based on new technology, restructuring society entirely. And a lot of our modern politics and modern science and modern philosophy, all of it's intertwined. A new political system brings with it new technology, new science, and also new understanding of history and a new religion. It's inherent. So if anyone is actually interested in changing things and breaking from this current trajectory, most people are very myopic. Even if they have a problem with like something, they don't realize that all of it's connected. And so to have a successful change, to have a successful, maybe not revolution, but like a new paradigm, a paradigm shift, you really have to understand all the various aspects of the current worldview and the current paradigm. And most people are not willing to examine what they know about religion, the structure of belief, the structure, like what they think they know about God or the gods or the heavens, about science, about morality, about, you go down the list. And the fundamental stuff is, again, 90% of people believe what the cultists using vanguard tactics convinced them of. And this process just continues over the centuries. And the fact that we're at these sort of child trannies now, I think, is a logical outcome of Plato and his and him writing The Republic. I can draw a line, and I was like, that's what it was aimed for. That's what it was leading to. And that's an easy one to do because Plato was a child groomer. So, you know, that one's pretty easy to do. But anyway, what do you think about that? I talk too much. I get excited. Let me throw it back to you.
Well, I could see why you get excited. I mean, it is overwhelming. To the average person, it's overwhelming in a way they just don't want to even to start to think about it. But to you or I, or those of us who really are trying to make sense of the world, it's also overwhelming in the sense it seems just bottomless. Like, where's the bottom? You think you get to the bottom, and it's another false bottom, and there's more layers to the onion. So yeah, I've had 100 different thoughts while I've been talking that I'd like to, I have to pick one of them. So which one? I mean, you ended on Plato, and I definitely want to get into Plato. I did even before you started talking about him, because I heard your perspective on Plato, and certainly this is foundational, to Western civilization. Probably everyone could agree on that who has any opinion about Plato, that his thinking was foundational. Now, I don't know Plato. I'm at a disadvantage with you and with this other person I'm about to mention, who you may or may not have heard of. He's called Matthew Errett, and he's a Canadian guy. He's got Canadian Patriot Society or something. And he does a lot of what seems like sterling research in terms of global long-term social engineering, including occultism. Like, he's one of the heavy lifters in terms of research, massive amounts of material out there. And we seem to get on fairly well, like just at a human level. But in my last conversation with him, he brought up Plato and how basically Plato's his go-to guy. He's the guy that he most respects. And I said, well, God, I always thought Plato was one of the bad guys, because that's what I basically picked up over the years for this and that reason, including ones that you've mentioned. And of course, he's like, no, no, no. And he kind of launched into something of a spiel, but nothing I could check or verify. Basically saying you have to read the text, right? So let's just spend a bit more time on Plato and what it is. I mean, what would you say to this guy who is aware of many of the things that you're aware of in terms of these nefarious agendas, but he's saying no, Plato actually is the solution, and you're saying he's the problem.
Well, again, it's a I can we can agree about the facts. So, for example, with Christians, for the longest time, I didn't know the facts, which is why I considered myself a Christian. But when I learned the facts, I consciously rejected it.
What's an
And what
example of a
happened?
fact? I'm just going to interrupt. What's an example of a fact around Christianity? It's just one example.
Well, the dogma, like what you're supposed to believe.
Oh,
I didn't know what I was supposed to believe. I thought I did, but
right.
a lot of Christians think that they know what they're supposed to believe, but like they don't. For example, the Nicene Credo, right? You have to believe that. I didn't know that was that was a requirement. I just
Okay.
sort of grew up culturally Christian, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
So, and then what I found is that I actually had a lot of agreement with Christians that really knew their stuff, like serious, dedicated like people who've done theological studies, because I was saying, okay, so basically you worship Yahweh, right? That's the name of your God. And they're like, yes. And you know, before that, I didn't know that as a Christian. I thought it was just God or whatever, but no. And you believe that the gods, that the Jews are gods, are Yahweh's chosen people, and he is the supreme deity. Yes. You believe Yeshua, Jesus, is literally Yahweh, and he's a fulfillment of all the prophecies of the Old Testament. So we just go down the list, we like get into specifics, and we're agreeing actually. And it's because of those reasons that I reject Christianity, but that's the reasons why they accept it.
Sure.
However, we basically agree on everything. There's this one Orthodox guy. He blocked me recently because I was agreeing with him too much. And if we get into occultism, mysticism, the big name in Orthodoxy is Father Seraphim Rose. He's this American. I think he was a struggling homosexual, and he converted to Orthodoxy, and he started writing about like the sort of mystical stuff and talking about occultism in American society in the West at the time. So he's writing in like the 70s and the 80s, and all this stuff is popular, New Age basically. And so he's going really deep into all of it, and he's explaining like transcendental meditation, he's explaining just the New Age movement and astrology, all this fascinating stuff. And at the end of the book, he says all of it is like his main thesis is that all of this is real. What they're tapping into stuff, powers that are ancient and that have been around, and that Christianity was created to basically destroy these powers, to rid the world of these spirits and these spiritual connections. So there is this one part that really stuck out to me. I think it was in Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future. It's one of his the biggest books he wrote, most well known. And he's talking about how basically people who go through occult training can open their spiritual eyes and start actually interacting with the spirit world, like start seeing things and all this sort of thing. And you know, when I read that, I was like, oh my God, that sounds awesome. And but his thing was God, specifically Yahweh, closed your spiritual eyes when your idols were destroyed. So Christians deliberately closed your spiritual eyes. And that's a good thing because you don't need those eyes because it's going to lead you astray. So you know what I mean? Like, and a lot of people were saying Christianity has destroyed our connection to the spiritual world. It's destroyed sort of native religions. It's destroyed this alternative, more like mystical spirituality. And this guy's saying, yes, that's exactly what we did, and we're proud of it. And we did it because our God told us to do so. That's the whole point of our religion, is to destroy the pagan world. And so that book for me was what led me into occultism, because I was so interested by these descriptions of these evildoers. And I was like, I really want to learn more about this. So it had a totally different effect on me. But you can see that you can basically have, so with the Plato thing, I think we'd probably be in agreement. It just comes down to a value judgment. There are these crazy people on Twitter right now, and there's this Zionist guy, a Romanian Zionist, and his name is Bronze Age Pervert. He's kind of an internet celebrity. Yeah, and he's really into Nietzsche and Plato. And his whole idea is he wants this sort of cruel elitism, like ostentatiously so, in a way that like an anti-moral, very like eugenic elite that's got the right mindset and that brutally purges anyone, and it's very materialistic, and it's very so, and you know, very demiurgic in the Platonic sense. So he went. He basically looked at everything Plato was saying, and he was like, I like it. And I actually agree with a lot of what his assessment would be. So I
Just
think that's
that
my
he
bigger
likes
point.
it, he likes it, and you don't like it. Well, it possibly, I mean, this isn't my impression of Matthew, but anyway, we don't have to linger on one example. I mean, I just have to bring the two of you together and let you fight it out. But
That'd be awesome. Let's do
yeah,
that.
oh, really?
I'm so, yeah, I'd love to do that.
Okay, well, I'll suggest it to him. I mean, once this airs, he can hear it because he subscribes to me and everything. So yeah, maybe that is a real possibility. There's a couple of things I want to answer or respond to. I might not get to both of them. One is the Christian thing. Maybe we can come back to that, but because I think we might agree and disagree at the same time on that one. But before that, what you were just talking about with the Bronze Age pervert and his kind of user-friendly Platonism, whatever we're going to call it, like he's adopted it for his own uses, let's say. I think another example of this that occurred to me while you were talking earlier was the Kabbalah, because you're saying how it kept emerging and then apparently disappearing and then re-emerging. One The way that I became aware of the Kabbalah was through occultism, you see, because you could say the Kabbalah also re-emerged in the 20th century via somebody like Aleister Crowley or Dian Fortune, like the occult movements of the 20th century, and both of those were in England, so I think a lot of them, maybe most of them, were in England, but also Theosophy. I mean, that was Russia. I'm pretty sure that Blavatsky must have referenced the Kabbalah. That was my in for the Kabbalah, and so I'm wondering if this is a good example of something we're talking around here, which is this what I've seen is this trickle down effect. Because part of what you're talking about, the way that a conspiracy, let's say, in shorthand, an agenda that's driven by methods and principles and philosophies, the way that it takes hold of a collective is that it becomes indigenous isn't quite the word, but it becomes, pervasive. And so we just take it on by osmosis, and then we actually ourselves become implements of that conspiracy. We ourselves are complicit with it to the degree that we're extending the very same principles and methods, but at a much lower level, like down here in the trenches. We're the serfs, but we're also the prison guards, right? We're prisoners who are prison guards. That's more or less my view of this. And so the Kabbalah and occultism to me is potentially an example of that. Here's an instrument of social control that keeps re-emerging precisely because it's so central to the reigning ideology. But it's also it's trickled all the way down to the very, so now you've got all these just seemingly independent-minded occultists who are practicing quote unquote Kabbalah and masturbating over the tree of life or whatever else they're doing. I used to meditate over the tree of life for like 4 hours a day, trying to create this internal architecture. And now I see it as MK Ultra. I'm pretty sure MK Ultra methods use the Kabbalah to compartmentalize psyches. So that is, I guess I'll just leave it over to you there. But that's an example to me of something that could be seen in many different areas.
Yeah, and another great example that I bring up because I sort of ground what I talk about in Russia and Russian history is communism. So communism was this radical, revolutionary, anti-Russian ideology, but it sort of became assimilated, somewhat half-digested, and it started taking on Russian characteristics towards the end. And the funny thing is that now, conservative-minded Russians are communists. Like, in the typical political divide in any country, the ones who want to be conservative and who are like for traditional like values or whatever, they're communists. I mean, isn't that crazy? Last year's extreme revolutionaries are this year's conservative, and the same thing is in America. So Tucker Carlson's saying, well, we all support, every sane person supports gay marriage. I, as a conservative, of course, support it. It's like Obama couldn't support that when he was a president. How far have we come in the last 10 years? And then he says also, I support Martin Luther King's vision. And it's like, well, Martin Luther King was literally a Marxist revolutionary as well. And you've taken, so yeah, we become the next generation takes the revolution, the previous generation's revolutionary ideals, and they become normal. We are all the products of yesteryear's revolution and the cumulative effects of many of these social engineering agendas. We already live in, say, a spook state, which means we basically live in Zamyatin's we, That dystopia has come to pass. We live in the new Atlantis of Bacon, and so that we live in that dystopia as well. There are for another one is 1985. It's written by Burgess, one of a British guy. I don't know if you've read him, A Clockwork
Burgess. Oh
Orange,
yeah,
and
Anthony Burgess. Yeah, he was absolutely intelligence affiliated, Burgess.
yeah, and 1985 is downright prescient because it talks about how TV, how there's this overstimulation and like everyone's just masturbating all the time, and there's like a no work movement, and there's Muslim mass migration. You go down the list, it's very prescient, and it's much more prescient than I'd say 1984, and it's sort of a parody of 1984. So yeah, we live in all of these dystopias, and these guys who are sort of revealing the agenda, they're all in on it. Like they're all part of, that's how they know about it. Zamyatin was a Bolshevik revolutionary. He was an Orthodox priest who realized that communism was implementing communist ideals. That was his, and he justified it that way. And it actually, his arguments make sense. It's what Marx said. It's what Bruno Bauer said. It's what Engels said. It's what Nietzsche said. It's what Schopenhauer said. They were all saying, yeah, well, communism is basically just the New Testament implemented, and capitalism is the Old Testament. So the people who run things follow the Old Testament because they get to be the capitalists and they get to own property and lend money at interest rates. And everybody else gets to be a communist. That is, they own nothing. They live communally and they're happy, and they'll get to heaven eventually, right? So, Marx was commissioned by communists, by Christians to. That was the whole point of Das Kapital, is to just to look at Acts, look at other early Christian material, and come up with an economic secular version of it. Basically, socialism, by and large, is based on Christian ethics. Applied to sort of like a just secularized, just sort of shorn of all that fairy tale stuff. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say, and I think we're kind of on the same wavelength here. But we're down to 2 minutes.
2 minutes,
Maybe we
yeah.
should,
2 minutes, yeah.
maybe you could.
I'm going to use the
Go ahead.
2 minutes to present a question to you, and then we'll restart. I'll give you a minute to think about it. How much is this a misapplication? Because I have a feeling that this Matthew guy who loves Plato, one of his answers is a bit of a trope, actually. There's the people who defend Marxism by saying, yeah, but everybody's done it wrong so far, right? But I think that's bullshit. But in this case, definitely, you could say that trying to apply the New Testament in the form of Marxism is getting it wrong. So maybe this Matthew Eric guy would say, yeah, but all this applied Platonism is just wrong. You have to go back, blah, 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 right? Maybe that's the area of disagreement. And certainly, this is how I feel about the New Testament. I do think it's a good book. I think it's been messed with and all the rest of it. But to me, it's a guide. There are guiding principles in there that I think have as much value as anything written, in the translated into the English language. The Old Testament, I'm less sure about. I focus on the Book of Job because that's the one book in the Old Testament that basically says the Old Testament's bullshit, don't listen to it. So I think that's pretty interesting that they managed to include that book in there. And it's a sort of it's a contradiction, right? It's basically like, saying, don't listen to me. Everything I say is a lie. Like, how do you get your head around that? But certainly there is wisdom, I'd say, in the Old Testament, and there's something I think that's maybe even beyond wisdom in the New Testament. I'm not a Christian, certainly not Judeo. I don't prescribe to any religion. I'm just making the case that what you're talking about isn't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily be laid at the feet of the scriptures themselves or even the people who created them, but in a kind of hubris approach to them.
Right. Well, my answer to that question, have you heard of I think it's a military term, and it's a phrase. It says the purpose of a system is what it does, and it's a POSIWID. It's some guy called Stafford Beer. He coined it, and it's a heuristic basically. And there's some interesting articles written about it. It's an interesting sort of concept consider. And that's my answer to a lot of this, is that you have to look at, the true purpose of, like, for communism, right? They always say, well, that's not true communism. There's it's not doctrinally pure or whatever, and therefore it doesn't count. Well, why is it that we see these common characteristics of communist regimes everywhere that they're implemented? And so at that point, even if it, ostensibly it's to create a society free of want and equality, it doesn't jibe with what actually happens, with what the system actually does, and we should define it by that heuristic instead of these sort of abstractions. It's just sorcery. Again, it's squiggles and lines and symbols on a blackboard. It's these theories that can't be proven. And when you look at the concrete, real results, and that's the whole point of this sort of magic, is this is an obscuring act. They don't want you to just observe the facts about what happened when the communists came to power. How did it look like? Why did it look so similar in every single country that this occurred? What's going on here? And then with Christianity, I like the fact that you don't like the Old Testament, and I totally agree. That's why I consider myself a Marcionite, because Marcion rejected the Old Testament, and he argued that there's no way that a loving God could have been depicted in the Old Testament. And in terms of biblical studies, the Book of Job is considered this, like, ancient sort of before, like, one of the oldest, I think the oldest story in the Bible, and not really connected to all the other ones. So that's interesting as well. So with the with that whole thing with Christianity, how there are structural elements of it that are very Platonist. In fact, you could call it Helleno-Judaism. And to understand what I think the goal of Christianity is, you have to understand occultism and the cult principles, and basically how magic works, and why Christianity is in the way that it's implemented. It's actually quite, because there's a lot of sayings of Christ that are very, it jibe pretty well with wisdom teachings all over the world. And but again, when it's implemented, it looks nothing like that. There's very little, I mean, it just becomes just window dressing, or almost an embarrassment to have all these wisdom teacher quotes in the religion.
Yeah, so
And I
well,
think
hold on. So let's just pause there then, because when you say when it's implemented, then what's being implemented then? Like, it'd have to be
it's
specific.
Plato's Republic. It's a xeno, it's a, what do you call it? A synarchy. It's ruled by priests, and like a caste of priests who conjure up social engineering through enforcement of morals, which are based on myths.
I mean, and I'm not going to argue with you that that's what Christianity is, and it's just the same old devil, with the same old wolf with different sheep clothes. But where's that in the where's that in the gospel, like, actually prescribing that? Where does it even say, hey, we need to create a movement here or anything like that?
It doesn't. Christ is mostly depicted as like a wisdom teacher, and all that stuff about the government, that's all the Old Testament. It's there has to be a Sanhedrin, there has to be a council of priests. Kings are bad in the Old Testament. The kings are proof of Israel's disloyalty. It should be a bunch of basically lawyers running them, theocratic rule. Quibblers, basically ruled by rabbi. That's what it's supposed to be in the Old Testament.
So
Now,
aren't we talking
so
about, oh, sorry, but just, yeah, I'll
go ahead,
continue.
go ahead,
I
go ahead.
interrupt. Yeah, aren't we talking about Judeo-Christianity then, really? Like, it's a Christianity that was co-opted by the Judaism, by the rabbis.
Well, Nicene Christianity in general is Super Judaism. It's a continuation and a fulfillment of Judaism. If you wanted a Christianity that had a clean break from Judaism, or that actually grew from a separate tradition like a Greek or a northern tradition, you would need to go basically to various so-called Gnostic movements that or to Marcion, where these people are basically saying we don't need the Old Testament. Well, the Jesus of the four books that were eventually chosen for the you need it for Matthew. All of Matthew is proving that Jesus is the fulfillment of all the Old Testament prophecies. And Marcion is, and these early people, the first 300 years, some they're writing and they're like, we well, you know, we didn't they weren't using the Old Testament clearly. And they said they knew of it, and they were like, why are they trying to force this Old Testament into our religion? So whatever they were like, well, we don't need the Old Testament to worship Christ in it, which is a fascinating thought. I agree that there are these, like the Gospel of John, for example, is considered the most Gnostic of them, and there's a Marcionite quote there which everyone ignores, where Jesus condemns the Pharisees and he says, we don't have the same father. Your father is a liar and a murderer, and he always was. And it's like, okay, well, he's condemning Yahweh there. And yet,
Absolutely, and
but
singling out the Pharisees and so constantly.
I actually try to avoid this sort of thing, this sort of theological interpretation, because that's what it boils down to. For example, I could interpret Paul as being a Gnostic, because there are direct quotes in the letters where he's attacking Moses and he's saying he's attacking circumcision. He tells Peter to chop his own dick off in Galatians. I mean, that's a direct quote. He says, look, man, if you're so obsessed with cutting your dick, just keep cutting next time. He's basically saying, cut it all off. You can look it up. It's, and what the church does is, and then he also says that Moses didn't speak to God. He spoke to a dark angel. And he says, he talks about these dark angels ruling the world, the archons. So lots of Gnostic stuff, but you know, a believer, he just sort of interprets it away, or he just doesn't, he's like, yeah, okay, he said that then, but then later we had Acts, like 100 years later we had Acts, and in Acts they said, no, it's all cool, and that's good enough for me, you know. But whatever, like if we get into Marcion, that's a fascinating topic. I mean, his father was apparently a student of one of the apostles, direct descendant, and you know, Marcion almost became, well, like he was very close to the, he may have become pope, or his friend may have become Pope Valentinius. Just like all the stuff that sort of validates his, like it was Marcion who discovered Paul's letters, and you know, his count of the original letters is less than you know, fake letters have been added since then. There's a lot of this that gets into sort of biblical scholarship, and you know, a believer is never ever gonna look into that. But a lot of this stuff was known in the 19th century. We're just sort of, it's become popular again to talk about it. And so in the last 10 years, it's become a popular thing, and that's why I've picked up on it. But this is sort of theology, and like I was saying, people will interpret it whatever way they want. So you could make an argument that Paul is a Gnostic, but you could also make an argument that he's Catholic or whatever, you know.
Sure, and it's in the end, I mean, maybe you're feeling this too. It's like a moving target. It's like, because this is what I addressed with my 200 joke to begin with. Like, I'm going to write about scripture here, guys, but you have to understand that scripture is pretending to try to do something that can never be done. Like, you just can't write about God or ultimate reality without getting it wrong, you know, by definition. So then when we try and talk about scripture even one step removed, you can end up getting pulled into this, I'm not going to say rabbit hole because it's such a cliche, but it's something else as well. It's like a Chinese finger trap or something, but you just constantly, like I said, the target keeps moving. Because people do what they will do with systems of belief, and I'm not talking about the people who create them to control now, but the end users. But it's both really. So you could say Christianity is a much older system of belief than communism, and I would say it has a much better source. I mean, I personally, I don't want to say I believe, because I think belief is a really bad idea, but Let's just say that I've had this felt sense for a long time that the New Testament is based on some guy who once walked the earth and who said some things. Let's just put it that way. So to me, there is some source there that I find is valuable. It's worth putting my attention on. I don't feel that way about Marx and communism, but in both senses, I mean, I think you can prove that Marx was a shady cat, from day one. Whereas with Yeshua, it's hard to even prove he existed, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that you can still apply the same criticism to both, in the sense that whatever, if there was any good in Marx, it sure didn't survive the transition to a political system called communism. Whatever good there is in the New Testament, and I think that's more demonstrable, it didn't survive the transition to Christianity. I don't think he even survived 100 years. I don't think he even survived the transition to the apostles, to be honest. So I think it died in its crib, and then something else, it's alive, took it over. And I think the same thing, to bring it back to specifics, but maybe create a bridge between this theology and the occultism, which is somehow a bit more tangible with Gnosticism, because like I used to identify as a Gnostic, not in a sort of proudful way, as in I'm one who knows, but just because that's the true Christianity. But then in the last 10 years or so, it's become more and more obvious to me that Gnosticism is, in more and more ways, seems compatible with the transhumanist, transgender, postmodernist, new age kind of reboot of these, whatever we're going to call them, but these ancient occult levers of social control. It seems like Gnosticism has become one of the trendy, delivery devices for that, or the structures, or the thing that is kind of been superimposed onto that. So I don't think even Gnosticism can be useful really as a if as a counterpoint or what have you. Anyway, so bringing it back to occultism, and Gnosticism is kind of like more overtly occult, I think, in terms of it has rituals and practices to try and get free of the archons. What's I'm going to end with a question, just so I'm not completely all over the place. What's your approach to occultism? Because it sounds as though maybe even it's kind of the opposite trajectory to my own, because I got into occultism very young, not very young, but in my 20s, because of Castaneda. And it was in my 40s that I ended up renouncing occultism, because it just got me into so much hot water. But I didn't swing all the way to born again Christian, like, oh, I want to have my eyes closed again, please. It's just that there was too much will to power baked into occultism for me. It wasn't just about opening one's eyes to see. It was about trying to see so that you can control and have power over. And that's the thing that I rejected in occultism. So how about for yourself? Like, what's your relationship with occultism currently?
I've read all of Castaneda as well. I really enjoyed it. But I really needed something more technical, like an actual how-to. And I've read so much, and the best, I think, overall overview was The Kybalion. Have you read that by Atkinson?
No.
Such a Oh, you haven't? Oh, Atkinson, I have to, well, if you're past that point, then, but for anybody that's sort of interested in just getting the overview, I think you can't go wrong with Atkinson. All of his stuff about he wrote like 200 books or 100 books. It was crazy, and he's self-taught. He basically got really, really sick, and then he had this miraculous recovery, and he had a genuine mystical experience, and he wrote all these books under various pseudonyms. And the best overview has been The Kybalion so far. But then so in terms of my practice, I spent like 4 years studying the theoreticals, and I'm not talking about like the names of the archons, and I never really even understood rituals until recently. I sort of was focused on the self-improvement aspect, and so I got into Castaneda, Gurdjieff, Muravyev. My real entry point was when I was Orthodox still. I just was like, well, look, I don't know why I have the capability to discern to this level, but I was looking at the rituals and stuff that you do, and I'm like, okay, this is all fake. I mean, this is all, I may as well be at the YMCA. Yes, I understand it's pretty and the stories are important. This was before I rejected all of that and the metaphysics and the theology. But where's the substance? Like, where's the mystical stuff? Like, I know that there's some of that in Orthodoxy. And the monks were, not the monks, the priests were very rude to me. And they kept telling me that I was spiritually deluded for wanting these things. And then it was various sort of hints and things that came along the way. Like I read the book, A Pilgrim's Journey, which is about this mystical pilgrim in 19th century Russia going around town, learning how to do magic. And he was a hesychast, and he accomplished this through the prayer of the heart. So I was like, that's interesting. I got to learn more about hesychasm. So then I read the Philokalia, and the priest got very upset that I had read that. It's Philokalia means the love of the beautiful, and it's supposed to be the mystical Bible of Orthodox Christianity. And I was getting a lot of there were some interesting hints here and there, and I was like, okay, I think I'm starting to get it. And then I read Jacob's Ladder, also a monastic classic. I was reading all this sort of, and then I got into Muravyev, and Muravyev claimed that he had written down the secret oral tradition of the monks of Mount Athos, who had passed it on to him, who said that it was time to share it with the world. And that was interesting as well. Basically, and bit by bit, I started realizing that it was yoga, that they had breath techniques, focus-based techniques, like concentration on candles, hand positions, body positions, lowering the heart rate. And I was like, oh, I know all this. This is at the time I was also doing Buteyko, which is just a breathing program to help people suffering with respiratory problems. So I was like, oh my God, all these monks are basically doing Buteyko. And then I realized, so then I just started doing more like sort of, what do you call it, a comparison type research, studying Tantra, studying Evola, just studying New Age, more science-based stuff written in the Western empirical language. And I came up basically with my own rudimentary system, where I realized there were three main elements, that basically this was all built on achieving the altered state. And the altered state was based on these brainwave states and the way and these internal vibration states. So basically the way to do this, the way to do mysticism is to learn how to cycle into these altered states. And you do that through these sort of levers or these dials that you have built into your biochemical feedback system. It's your breath, your concentration, how relaxed you are, how tense you are. And so I realized there's really three main elements, relaxation, breath control, and focus, concentration. So various combinations of the three open up these various brainwave states. And I started having success with alpha, which is sort of the beginning state when you're calm. Your periphery vision is working. You're not in fight and flight. You're in rest and relax. You're in the parasympathetic system. You feel warm, and you've got like you may even start feeling the beginnings of energy movement. And then I had a couple of out of body experiences. I had three out of body liftoffs. Started experimenting with lucid dreams. I'm still trying to master that now. It's quite tricky. Kept meditating and kept sort of building on my own system bit by bit. And so that's pretty much the concrete of what I do. In terms of like how I feel about it, you're right, but there is this will to power. But what appeals to me is not that it's sort of like Sauron from Lord of the Rings, will to material power and dominion. It's not Nietzsche's will to power, which again, it's very materialistic, it seems. It's sort of will to power over oneself. It's about learning to the power in question is not a metaphor, it's Shakti, it's your chakra or whatever you want to call it. It's your like internal kundalini your internal tree of whatever the Kabbalah tree. So it's about self-mastery. And I don't, again, it's just a value judgment at the end of the day. And this is Satanism. This is pure Satanism, because Satanism is defined as everything that is not Yahweh approved. And anything, any source of power that is like, so in Russia, for example, they'll say stuff like martial arts is satanic, because most people don't do this when they do martial arts, but these were esoteric religions actually masquerading as martial arts. And it's all about manipulation of altered states and internal energy flows on a certain high enough level, right? And so the Orthodox know that, and so they condemn it. They condemn yoga. They condemn a lot of practices that might increase your own personal power and self-mastery. And when I realized that, that was the final break. I was like, this is obviously a slave. Like, this is obviously a concoction to enslave and weaken people to make sure that an elite does retain these powers, these occult abilities. Maybe not these in particular, because these require discipline and training. And but there are other dark forces, there are other dark elements of the occult, and this thing prevents people from learning about it, from learning how to combat it, how to arm themselves against it. It makes them into slaves. And then I learned more about the history of it and like the theological ideas that I think are dangerous and subversive. And so that was sort of the thing. It's a long answer, but I do you want to jump? What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, it's a good, it's a necessarily long answer. I think I was right that in a certain sense we've crossed like on parallel tracks or ships in the night, you going in one direction and me in the other, although that would suggest, we'd never meet again. And I'm not sure that's true, because I think, I mean, we are meeting here now anyway, so somehow going in opposite directions we have met. Because the conclusions that you reached after Orthodoxy, I reached them, a very early age. When I had a brief stint in my early 20s or my late teens where I thought I wanted to be a filmmaker, where I was kind of materially driven or in terms of worldly goals. But the bottom fell out of that, and as I said, I discovered Castaneda, and that just opened my cognitive vision, if you like, in terms of, oh my God, there's so much more here. And so yeah, I was hell bent on self-development, to use a more neutral term, for 20 years after that. And I did all these practices. I found Castaneda was quite practical, in a way. And so, I developed lucid dreaming and out of body travel and this, that, and the other. I also did a lot of psychedelics. So that kind of cancels out my achievements, I think. But the main point, I think, here that I'll make, as maybe as a counterpoint, is that I realized that there's a subtler kind of will to power in me, at least, that, I mean, you did acknowledge this, that was in my drive for development or self-mastery. Not simply in that I wanted to master myself so that I could master others, although there is that possibility, but in the sense that I didn't realize what was driving me to want to master myself. And in my 40s, I mean, I had some sense that I was trying to escape something for sure, because that's just sort of logical. Like, if you're trying to improve yourself or develop yourself or master yourself, it's because you're not comfortable or at peace, and you're not you personally, but one is trying to find a solution. So of course I was aware of that, but that I just basically couldn't be content until I'd attained some imaginary status of enlightenment or whatever it might be. But in my 40s, after I met my wife, I became more and more aware that in my own life, I had this buried trauma. And it was a weird process of discovery, because it brought together these two main areas of interest in my life. One was spiritual seeking, for lack of a better word, or occultism, the occult pursuit of self-knowledge, let's say. And the other was the research into conspiracies and every, of every shape and form. That those two interests actually became one interest as I became aware of my own trauma as a result of looking more and more into organized child abuse and why that was central to the systems of control and the occult philosophies that shape our world. I mean, well, we can get into that, all the way back to Plato and beyond. I began to see that I myself was being driven by trauma, by sexual trauma, to pursue occult power and knowledge. It was a kind of Lucifer. I mean, it was literally Luciferian because I identified with Lucifer in my 40s, and I didn't worship Lucifer because I knew better than that, but I identified with. I wanted to embody Lucifer, not as some evil principle, but in the Steiner understanding as this light bringing power of imagination and freedom and stuff, but also to redeem something I saw had been scapegoated. I believed had been sort of scapegoated and disowned by the collective. So that's my long response. But as I say, it didn't. I haven't gone. The pendulum didn't swing back. It did swing back to the extent that I became quite anti-occultism and more aligned with the Christian and generally the religious approach of surrendering to a higher force. That to that extent it did, but not to the extent of actually wanting to submit or resubmit to these kind of control, the ideologies of control that you're talking about. Like I mean, you can't unknow things. I haven't disowned the occult knowledge that I've developed. I've just had to accept that it wasn't really as useful as I thought it was, and that it seemed to me that in it was baked these kind of trauma-generated drives that essentially I felt I needed to get free of. So currently, my practice is really the classic or the cliche of chopping wood and carrying water, like I'm trying to get self-sufficient and start a farm in Spain and stuff. And so I just spend a lot of time doing shit work, and I do find that actually works for me in a way that all this other stuff didn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of overlap for sure. But yeah, a lot of overlap. I'm just thinking about my motivations for it. Well, I mean, the main essay that I'm working on now, a series, I call it The Metaphysics Conspiracy. So I'll just pivot to that. And I think, like you said, you were into the occult and conspiracies, and they merged into one. Same thing for me, except I think that there was a conspiracy to change our understanding of metaphysics, of basically higher realities. And there are a lot of things that we assume about higher realities now, even if we're atheists, like just about what other like the parameters of the possible. So that there is this one God, one creator God, that he has to be good. We have these structures that we understand, like we all understand the concept of an angel, and if we don't believe in it, we all understand the concept of there's just like all these inherent things about metaphysics that even people who don't believe, they've sort of accepted a lot of it. But most of it was accepted or engineered as part of a radical social revolution agenda, which was spearheaded by Plato. So Plato. And a part of this is like you won't hear him explicitly state it. So that's where, you do have to sort of read between the lines about what's going on here. But Plato is quite clear and about that he is against the gods. He wants to get rid of the gods. He wants to ban Homer's Odyssey from being recited in his ideal society of the future. He thinks that it's disrespectful to divinity to portray these gods in a bad light, because the ancient view of gods is pessimistic, right? They're capricious, they're not really looking out for you. They're sort of they can help you or they can destroy your whole life just at a whim. It's a very unflattering picture that traditional ancient cultures have of the gods. And Plato is trying to engineer a new society, and he says, well, look, how is it that you can't have gods that are immoral? Because then how can you have priests that would be paragons or examples of morality? And the people he associates with are atheists. That's the accusation against Socrates, that he's an atheist and that he's been pummeling the heads of his young students with this ideology that he's come up with basically Bolshevism. Plato's students got caught launching a revolution in Syracuse, and he has to write a letter to Dion, where he's basically saying, I had nothing to do with it. And you know what, you guys, he did the whole this isn't true Platonism argument. He said, look, whatever similarities his thing may have had to my ideas, this isn't true Platonism. I had nothing to do with the blood that was spilt. And by the way, you should let him go. And when his friends launched the coup to take over the city, what do? They're iconoclasts. They smash the statues of the gods, and they basically are an atheist terrorist organization. And they just and they so there's a lot of key points that sort of overlap. So Plato has never specifically stated that his goal is to reform our understanding of metaphysics, but you can kind of figure it out based on all his other actions. So he's trying to change our understanding of magic, of the higher divinities and everything. And this practice is also continued by all of his successors. So on a fundamental level, he introduces the Demiurgos. And the Demiurge, as it later is called, is this absentee creator deity. And this is atheism in several senses. One, because it denies all the other gods. The traditional gods, the Greek gods, the family gods. Every Greek family had family gods as well, which was basically the spirits of their ancestors. And it's basically an atheism because it's a form of deism. And deism is the only form of atheism that's logically consistent. You can't really be an atheist and be logically consistent in the modern school of atheism, because they claim that out of nothing came something, right? And that makes no sense. That's like a you can't square the circle on that one. That one doesn't work. And yet all atheists nowadays believe that. It's an occultism of its own kind if you believe that out of
It's
nothing came
not
something.
nihilism, isn't it? Really, you strip it down, it has to be nihilism. Is that
It's
funny?
just inconsistent on some you like you like if you're gonna be consistent, how do you get something out of nothing? It's just so basic. There had to be something before, there had to be a prime mover. It just makes sense. But deism is like the furthest you can take atheism. Yes, you have your prime mover, the clockmaker of the universe. He wound up the clock, he made the rules, and then he left. He stepped out. So that's basically what Plato has invented. With God and the gods out of the way, and all supernatural forces treated as superstition, you basically have a green light for your social engineering agenda. Nothing can mess with it. You've basically, and then he goes down the list of all the stuff that's going to change. So instead of having a system that's based on like metaphysical realities, like why do you do this instead of that? Why do you chop wood first instead of getting water first? And you say, well, it's a symbol of like my understanding of the heavens or something, right? Why do you have these moral laws and not other ones? Well, because we believe that this deity stands for, and so Plato explicitly states, we're going to create fake myths for people to believe in. And from those fake myths, we're going to create a moral code around them, because no one will believe in a moral code unless it's, comes from God or something. You can't just, and we're not going to have anybody interfere with our agenda. Because we're not going to allow people to believe in anything else. So if people start believing in gods and like metaphysical truths, that might interfere with their loyalty to the dictates of the ruling class of guardians, of priests, of people who tell you what to believe. So he's trying to create a totally artificial system based on the noble lie, which is some foundational lie myth. About a special god or like a special narrative, religious narrative, special founder. He explains it all in detail. It's just a manual, a how to subvert society manual. He's an iconoclast. He wants to destroy the idols. He wants to destroy he wants to destroy history, because if you get rid of the stories of the gods, this is actually a culture's history, because a lot of the stories of the gods are also a history of cosmological phenomenon. You know, like they're also gods and they're also planets. And so some of these stories are telling about moments when things in the heavens were moving, right? When Mars was out of alignment, when Saturn may have been in a different position, and then it was beaten out by Jupiter, by Zeus, and then the current alignment came about. There's like a cosmo theological aspect to this. And so you're banning a lot of things when you ban the gods. And Aristotle builds on that, and he explicitly states it. Like he's saying, like, we're getting rid of all this because of that. So you see, there's this metaphysical conspiracy. And one of the things, the last thing I'll say, and then I hand it back to you, and then we can reconvene if you still have some energy left, is why I think if you were trying to sort of get rid of magic or trying to get rid of the metaphysical, the transcendent in society, if you were trying to create a totally materialistic, socially engineered system of control where you and your buddies basically run things and nothing can interfere with it, you would basically love Plato. And Plato's agenda, what he's trying to get rid of, I started thinking about, well, what if what he's trying to get rid of is real? You know, if what if these old techniques and old methods and old approaches to divinity, what if those are the real ones? What if those are the ones that work? And that's why he's trying to get rid of them or trying to subvert them, because he sees them as a potential source of power that could not be controlled by society's engineers. And I hand it over to you if you want. We can expand on this topic, but what are your thoughts on that?
I can bite you on your arm.
It tastes delicious.
Like a flush red apple skin. I know you don't mean harm.
You seem suspicious.
Right, well, I'm going to end the free version of this conversation here. For the full 2 hour plus conversation, you will need to find your way over the paywall one way or another. Simplest way is just to sign up as a paid subscriber. It's €8 a month or €80 for the year if you go directly to me via PayPal, jason@protonmail.com. Just make sure that the fees are covered at your end, or you can avoid them by making it a gift. Or if you do it through Substack, it is slightly more, because Substack take their 10% tithing.
To have his heart beat slowly,
slowly.
I just want to have some fun,
so fun
and feel a bit less lonely. But I don't mind it. Never will hear the warning that you might be sounding. I just feel my face warming and my heart start pounding, pounding for your
mind it. He doesn't mind it. He doesn't mind it.
doesn't mind it. He doesn't mind.